Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Calcio Land Podcast. So today we are going to talk about Pirlo's shocking appointment as Juve's manager. Alex and I will talk about that at the top. We have our good friend Carlo Garganese. I wanted to bring him back on to talk about Sarri's only season at Juve and the decision to hire Pirlo. So I think you'll enjoy hearing Carlo's perspective. We'll do a couple of hot transfer topics. I'll talk a little bit about Juve, a new target at left back for Napoli. We'll, of course, do a part of the podcast just for patrons. And as promised, I definitely wanted to talk about Atalanta since their Champions League game is coming up and we hadn't spoken about them in a while. So I had our good friend Mark Doyle come on to chat about Atalanta, and that will be available to all to close the show. But let's talk about Pirlo. So on Friday, Alex texted me all worried about what this means for Jorginho to Juve, and I reminded Alex that Sarri isn't the only manager that likes Jorginho, so let's see how much that changes there. But there's a ton to unpack as far as Pirlo as new manager. So let me ask you, Alex, what was your reaction? This is two times in a row that Sarri is let go and replaced by a club legend midfielder. As you pointed out, Pirlo and Lampard were together at New York City FC. I remember being in the locker room and seeing both of them there, and they both replaced Sarri. But aside from that angle, in general, what do you make of Pirlo being put as Juve manager with no experience whatsoever?
Well, yeah, I mean, forget the fact that they're close. And I am a little pessimistic on Pirlo wanting Jorginho before someone like Tonali. But besides that, forgetting that they're even close, it's just so similar because, like you said, it's a legendary midfielder with almost no experience in Lampard's case, no experience in Pirlo's case, replacing Maurizio Sarri. And the way they both kind of happened, I mean, Pirlo's happened even quicker. That, I mean, there was no rumor to even be had because he goes from U23 coach to, boom, going to be Juve's coach. So in comparison, it wasn't drawn out at all compared to Lampard, even though that still kind of was quick when you look at with Lampard and Sarri. It was, oh, wow, Sarri, okay, you know, he's turned it around. He's not going to get sacked anymore, but he still might leave, wins the Europa League. Boom, he's out the door. And yes, Lampard, he's in. And it was fairly quick as well. But just beyond that, from a Juve perspective, I view this right away when I think about this. I think to myself, why not? Because as long as he's not abysmal as a manager, as a coach, they still should always have a chance to win the Scudetto. And on the chance that he just is someone, and I don't want to say he's going to be Zidane or he's going to be Lampard or any new coach that has done well that's a former player, but whether he is amazing right off the bat or meh, he really has some work to do, they should be in contention. And I guess you could say there could be a high reward. He could be the perfect fit and it could just work right away. And he's not going to be the perfect manager right away. But who knows? Players playing for Pirlo? David, I guess I have actually kind of keen perspective because I just witnessed a year of not just young players busting it for a manager that was a player they all looked up to, but senior players. Like, senior players all looked up to Frank Lampard. Same with Pirlo. This isn't just going to be an effect now where young players want to work hard for Pirlo. This could be an effect throughout the dressing room. And when I think about what was maybe lacking in Juve's dressing room this season, I'm not saying Sarri doesn't have control of a dressing room. I'm not saying that there's this toxicity within a dressing room, but I know it's always not harmonious with Sarri. Some players, and this is a little bit more from the Chelsea side of things, but I know there's got to be some of this at Juve. Some players find the trainings tedious and there's not always the greatest opportunity to connect with the manager. So I know that it's not what it's like with Lampard. And I would imagine like it's like with Pirlo or like it will be like. So I think this is actually, maybe this is crazy to say, I think this is actually kind of low risk, high reward. Now for Pirlo's legacy, that's different. But for Juve, yeah, I think this is actually a great move. And maybe I'm biased because I saw how beneficial it could be in Chelsea's scenario. Not the same scenario, but still, Juve are in better position than Chelsea even were. So I like it. So that was my answer. I still was taken back by it, even though we kind of knew this could happen, just because it was so profound. It went from Sarri being sacked to, oh my God, could it be Pirlo? Oh my God, it's going to be Pirlo. And when that happens on Twitter, it's always a wild, wild ride. But
yeah,
it was fun, and I'm really excited about this. Kind of feel bad for Maurizio, and I think you're spot on. To continue my long-winded way, you're spot on. He needs to do a Bielsa, or he just needs to find a team that he can be truly Maurizio Sarri with. But yeah, I like it. I still want to dive more into it by listening to your answer, David. So what did you think of all of it?
So very interesting that you brought up the locker room and the trainings and all. So let's start with Sarri being sacked. I think at the end of the day, the senators at Juve were done with him. And when I say the senators at Juve, it's the Buffon, Chiellini, certain extent Bonucci as well. In retrospect, it was significant that Barzagli left Juve mid-season as well. So that was and he was on the coaching staff, another veteran that left there. And Max Nerozzi, who used to cover Juve for La Stampa and is now at Corriere della Sera, had a very interesting article how Sarri the locker room never really warmed up to him. He actually had an anecdote from the summer when Juve played Spurs during their tour, and Sarri made a comment that Juve was losing that match, and he said to the team, how did I lose 2 Scudetti to you guys? And that really rubbed people the wrong way, and after that, he never fully recovered from that. And I think for the Senators, having Pirlo, who obviously was their teammate and a friend, I'm sure they're very happy. I have a feeling this also was throwing a bone at Ronaldo. There was a lot of reports that Ronaldo wasn't thrilled about the very tactical approach by Sarri in training. Sarri wanted Ronaldo to play purely as a center forward. That didn't work out. It sounded that there really never was a great relationship with Sarri. As I mentioned last week, Ronaldo and Dybala in a lot of ways bailed out Sarri many times, but they're not the typical forwards that play for him. They don't really track back, press, or really allow Sarri to do his style. So long and short of it, it really was a marriage that didn't work out. And you guys know I love Sarri, but in a way I'm relieved. And I love to see him at a team where, like Bielsa, where he can just do his thing. As far as the Juve side of things, I'm really surprised by the way they went about it, because for years we talked about Juve being pragmatic, about having this planning, multiple year planning, having things lined up. And this kind of felt like a knee jerk reaction, because just 8 days before appointing Pirlo, they had made a big deal of announcing him as the under 23 manager. They had also said that he was gonna, that he had to earn his dues, that he had to learn, and they were having him learn at the under 23 to kind of groom him for the top job. So 8 days after, they changed their mind, put him as the senior manager. Now, was this a Machiavellian ploy where they were kind of trying to ease in Pirlo for the role, and they knew all along that he was then going to coach the senior team? I don't buy that. If you do, okay. Fine, maybe it's possible, but I don't think that is the case. I think this is a huge gamble by Andrea Agnelli, and make no mistake about it, at the end of the day, when it comes to the coaches, he's the one that makes that decision. It's a little less risky than Conte, if you will, for a couple of reasons back in the day, because Juve was really not doing well back then. They were coming off 2 7th-place finishes. Conte did have some track record where he had done pretty well. He had done well at all the clubs except for Atalanta, his only time in Serie A. But Andrea Agnelli was really enamored with what he saw by Conte, and he's very close to Pirlo. So made that decision there. If it works out, great for him. I see what you're saying, Alex. Low risk, high reward. Yes, I mean, Pirlo has a low salary, 2-year deal. If it works out, great. Juve looks like geniuses for putting him there. If it doesn't work out a year from now, they can go back after Pep or Pochettino, someone of that nature. As far as how Pirlo is going to be as manager, I'm not going to pretend that I have any idea what that's going to look like. He hasn't done his thesis at Coverciano, the school for coaches in Italy. He'll do that later this year. He's not fully licensed. to be in the Champions League, he's going to have someone sit on the bench for him there. So in a sense, not a big gamble financially, but at the same time, you have Ronaldo who's 35 and, you know, you have an unproven coach. So let's see what happens there. I definitely think that the whole idea of Juve being these great planners, pragmatic, maybe that goes out the window a little bit, but certainly an interesting decision and never a dull moment with Calcio. So now let's get the perspective from our friend Carlo Garganese on this as well. Okay, so with the big news over at Juve, Sarri out, Pirlo in. I know we had just spoken about Juve not long ago on the podcast, but we definitely wanted to address this. I was trying to figure who would be a good guest to discuss this, and there was really nobody better than my dear friend Carlo Garganese. A, it's been way too long since we had him on the pod, but Carlo, like me, is a big Sarri fan, but he's also a very objective Sarri fan. So I figured we put a bow around Sarri's first and only season at Juve and talk a little bit about the very surprising appointment of Andrea Pirlo. So Carlo, it's always wonderful to speak to you, my friend. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Yeah, no, it's a great pleasure to be back on the show. Thanks for having me, David.
Okay, so let's start with Sarri. So both you and I have been big fan of his for a long time, but probably more of the earlier version of Sarri as opposed to the new version that we've seen at Chelsea and especially at Juve. So tell me a little bit, when you think about Sarri's 13 months at Juve, what's going to come to mind? For me, it comes down to that the announcement of his hiring was much more surprising than the announcement of his firing. So I want to ask you kind of what your perspective is. And when you look at this season at Juve, I think, you know, the one Scudetto, sure, important, but losing two finals, the Coppa Italia Super Cup, an elimination against a very easy opponent in the round of 16 has to be disappointing. But do you see Sarri as the biggest culprit for this?
No, Sarri's not the biggest culprit. I think he's way down on the list. When Sarri was appointed, he was set up to fail. There's no doubt about it. And for me, he hasn't been a failure. The only areas where he really failed in terms of on the pitch would be those finals, the Super Cup against Lazio and the Coppa Italia final. But to be honest with you, you know, they're quite minor trophies, and I don't think anyone's really going to cry for too long about not winning those finals. And he won the Scudetto, and he obviously failed in Europe. But to be honest with you, you could have put anyone in charge of this Juventus squad. You could put Pep Guardiola, you could put Jurgen Klopp, you could put Sarri, or you could put the new surprise appointment, Andrea Pirlo. It doesn't matter who you appoint. No one could succeed. No one could challenge for the Champions League with this squad. And that's the bottom line. And I think those that are attacking Sarri just need to take a reality check and actually have a look at the Juventus squad, because it's simply not good enough. I mean, both of us said it at the beginning of the season. It's obvious for anyone that's objectively looking at Juventus' squad, it's not strong enough. I mean, we could be here till midnight looking at all the gaps and the holes. You know, how there's a right winger playing at right back, how there's no backup left back. You know, how the central midfield has been a disaster for 3 years. For 3 years, they haven't spent a penny on transfer fees on the central midfield. You know, we've heard all season about Juventus supposedly having this great depth in their squad. Yet, when they needed to beat Lyon the other night, they had to bring on Marco Olivieri, plays for the under 23 team. It's scored four goals for Juventus under 23s this season. You know, where's the depth? You know, the squad has been constructed horribly by the chief football officer Fabio Paratici, and he's the first one to blame. And really, you know, if someone was going to lose their job, I'm sorry to say this, but he should have been on the firing line, you know, well before Sarri. So So yes, listen, I'm not going to say that Sarri is absolved of the blame. Yes, Juventus should still be beating a team like Lyon, who, you know, seventh in Liga, played one competitive game since March. You should still be winning those games. But in terms of the bigger picture of actually challenging for the Champions League, which is Juventus's dream and objective, whatever, you know, Leo Bonucci and the others want to say is their objective, no one has a chance with this squad. That's the bottom line. And the only positive from going out against Lyon is the fact that Juventus won't have to suffer an absolute hammer from Manchester City. So that's the only positive.
Absolutely. Yeah, very well said. And look, you know, I think both things can be true at the same time. Sarri was set up to fail and he could have done better. I think that's a fair assessment, but it was just always a very odd marriage. So before we get to kind of the decision making to bring in Pirlo, because I'm really fascinated by this, because it on the surface, it seems to go really against the way Juve does things. And I stress on the surface. Let me just ask you in general, what's your reaction to just the idea that Pirlo is now Juve's manager?
I'm stunned, to be honest. I mean, anyone that's been following Juve, you know, as long as I have, and knows the club, or anybody that knows the club and how they work and how they're a very conservative, pragmatic club, to take such a gamble on a coach that has no coaching experience, who was only just appointed as the under 23 coach in his first coaching job last week, you know, and only just completed his coaching badges. I mean, it's a massive, massive gamble. I didn't see it coming. The people that I know that are close to Juventus didn't see it coming until like an hour, 2 hours before. You know, it's took everyone by complete, you know, complete surprise. So I don't know how much, if it was planned or if it was, you know, I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. It's not the way that Juventus usually do things. And for me, it's just a bit of a shot in the dark, really, because how can anyone predict how Pirlo is going to do? We really don't know. We haven't seen him coach. Theory is very different to actually, you know, you can talk a good game. We see a lot of pundits, you know, that are brilliant in the studio analysing games. You know, Gary Neville is a good example in England. He's a fantastic pundit analysing matches on TV, but he was one of the worst managers there's ever been when he was at Valencia. So, you know, it's really difficult to say. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go. I've interviewed Pirlo, he's a very, very quiet person. To be honest with you, and this is coming from someone who worshipped him as a player, I was quite a boring interview. It was difficult to get anything out of him. He didn't have much to say, despite having such an incredible life and career to talk about. Very monotone, robotic, the way he isn't someone that struck me as someone that will inspire people with his words. Obviously, you know, that's not the only thing with managing. It's not just about motivating and being able to be a leader, which I don't think he is. He's quite introverted. So, yeah, we'll have to see. The cynic in me thinks that this is possibly he's keeping the seat warm for say, a Pep Guardiola when his Manchester City contract expires next year. And obviously, Pirlo's a low-cost appointment, and Juventus have financial issues. You know, they've got this astronomical wage bill, which, you know, they couldn't really afford to appoint, say, someone like Mauricio Pochettino, who would have commanded, like, 10 million a year, whereas Pirlo's probably going to be on, what, 1, 2, 3 million maybe a year? I'm not sure the figures. So yeah, it's there's a lot of reasons why I think maybe Juventus went for it, but at the end of the day, it's a massive gamble.
Okay, so let's dig a little bit more about the thought process, or maybe lack thereof, at Juve with disappointment. So definitely finances, as you pointed out, in my opinion, are a huge factor here. Pirlo is going to earn a reported around 2 million net a season. To put things in perspective, Conte earns 12 million. Sarri earned about three times what Pirlo is going to make So I think definitely finances were a big part of this. Keep in mind, Juve asked their players to take a big pay cut this spring because of the virus. But what's interesting to me is the thought process here. So Juve said they weren't going to make a decision based on just one game with Lyon, but they did appoint Pirlo as the under-23 manager about a week ago. They had made a point of saying that Pirlo had to pay his dues, earn the right to become a senior squad coach. But then they turn around after the loss to Lyon and put Pirlo as manager. So kind of what's your opinion on this thought process? As you mentioned, Juve is known for being very pragmatic, known for making a lot of planning. But here it doesn't really feel like that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a bit of a head scratcher. It's not how, as I said, it's not how Juventus do their business. Certainly not how someone as ruthless as Andrea Agnelli does his business. So yeah, I think finance is definitely playing a big role. I think that possibly Agnelli is looking at Juventus' squad. It's an aging squad. It's a squad that realistically needs so much work done before it can really challenge for the Champions League. But I think Juve are at least 2 to 3 years away from challenging for the Champions League. I think there's just too much work that needs to be done, too many areas of the pitch and position. So maybe he's looking at that and he's thinking, this is going to really be a transitional season. And, you know, Andrea Pirlo's not going to cost anything. If it goes wrong, then he's easily dispensable, both from a financial point of view and also from a point of view of, okay, he's not experienced, it hasn't worked. So that might be factored into Agnelli's thinking. What kind of concerns me is more, as you said, it sounded from the under-23 presentation that this, you know, that they actually genuinely were planning for Pirlo to be the under-23 coach. So, you know, was this just an immediate reaction to going out that Agnelli just thought, right, let's go for it? I don't know. I find it strange, to be honest with you. And the other thing to consider, and this is going to be absolutely crucial, is Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean,
yeah.
Cristiano Ronaldo at 35 years of age, you know, would you stay at Juve that are gambling on a totally unproven and inexperienced coach in the last years of your career? I mean, from his point of view, I think if he wants to go to PSG, I think he could go there. So that's the other big question mark. And did Ronaldo know in advance that Pirlo was coming? I mean, Ronaldo did put out an Instagram post after the loss to Lyon where he kind of suggested like he would be back next season, but that was before the Pirlo announcement. So what will he be thinking? If he didn't know about this, I'm not sure how happy he will be, to be honest with you. So there's a lot of question marks and uncertainty. And I honestly don't think anybody seems to know whether this was planned or whether this was just just Agnelli just reacting immediately to the defeat and appointing him.
Yeah, well said. So let's have two final questions for you. Looking right now, and look, things can change. We have transfer windows. There's Conte kind of meltdown, but I fully expect Conte to stay at Inter. But as things are right in this precise moment, in your opinion, who's the favorite for the next Scudetto?
As things are right now, I think you have to go with Inter. But obviously, a lot can change because, you know, the transfer market hasn't even officially opened in Serie A, and it's not going to close till very, very late this year. Is it October, the end of the transfer
market?
It is, isn't it? It's the beginning of October. So there's a long, long way, 2 months almost, still to go in this transfer market. And, you know, a lot can change. But realistically, I mean, there's so much uncertainty over Juventus and Inter. yeah, if they keep everyone in the team and they add just a couple more pieces, so they've already bought Hakimi, who's a fantastic player down the right and the right back role. I think Inter look quite stable, but you know, it should be quite an exciting title race next season, because when we saw it was a lot closer this year, and you know, there's other teams that can also make this the battle at the top even more exciting. So I think we could be in for an exciting title race next season.
Absolutely. So let's close on this. As I mentioned at the top, both you and I are big Sarri guys, dating back to his time at Empoli. I have to say, you know, since then, I don't think there's any team that I've enjoyed as much as Empoli, although Napoli Sarri was pretty great. If you had to pick, where would you like to see Sarri next?
I hope he doesn't sit out and just, you know, for this contract at Juventus end, because he's not young, and you know, he hasn't got that long left. So yeah, it would be nice to see him take another job. Who that would be, I don't know. I mean, I think it would have been quite nice to see him take on Fiorentina.
Yeah,
that's what I would have liked to see, because they've got a young team. They've got the kind of players that probably would have been quite suitable to his football. I'm thinking, in midfield, the likes of like Amrabat, Castrovilli, even Chiesa, who else have we got? Even Ribéry, even though he's old, these are all players that are technically good. They've got a good short game. They can press and play the kind of total football that Sarri wants, in the sense that I think at Juventus with Sarri, it was difficult, especially with Ronaldo, maybe to a little extent Dybala. You know, they're quite individual players that don't necessarily play in a typical formation. So it was difficult for him to really have the same system that he had at Empoli and maybe to a lesser extent at Napoli, where there wasn't really one superstar or two superstars that were kind of allowed to do their own thing. They didn't allow to have their own freedom. And I think maybe at Fiorentina, he could definitely transport that there. But obviously we've seen Beppe Iacchini's team. I don't understand why the decision was made, but he's been given a new contract. I think that was a really bad decision, to be honest with you. But yeah, Fiorentina would have been nice. I'm not really sure who else there is really. I mean, maybe Roma, because I'm not sure how certain Fonseca is in that job, but they need a lot of work as well, Roma. They've got quite a few aging players as well. So, yeah, Fiorentina for me, but I don't know. I don't think it's particularly likely now.
Yeah, no, but I definitely agree that sort of profile for a club would be ideal for him. But Carlo, I can't thank you enough, my dear friend. It's been way too long since we chatted. Thank you so much for giving us your perspective on Sarri and Pirlo, and I look forward to chatting again with you real soon, my friend.
No, you're welcome, mate. Get well.
All right. Great stuff from Carlo. And now let's get to hot transfer topics, because it is certainly transfer season, David. Let's start off with this. This one is brand spanking new. What did you make of Matuidi leaving Juve for Inter Miami?
Yeah, and first of all, I know you have a big grin today, Alex, because we're recording right after Inter eliminated Havertz and one step closer to Chelsea. But Matuidi, yeah, this was another one that came out a little bit out of the blue today. So Juve is releasing Matuidi of his contract, has 1 year left, doing a favor to him. I would also point out they are doing a favor to Mino Raiola, who's his agent, and we know Juve does a lot of business with Mino, so they're doing him a solid there, releasing him. I think they take a very minor loss on the amortized value left for Matuidi, but they shed a big salary, $3.5 million net, so $7 million before taxes off the books. Look, are there worse midfielders on Juve than Matuidi? Yeah, but at least there's somewhat of a market for him, even though no transfer fee, they at least get off his contract. I think Juve will try to do the same with Khedira and Higuain. Let's see if they can find a suitor that will pay for them or if they'll just release him and move on. I have a feeling neither Kadira and Higuain will also be on the squad. I think Juve just wants to turn the page now.
Hmm. All right. Well, they can still have Jorginho. And I'm not at all hating on Jorginho, but he's just not going to fit at Chelsea from here on out. Let's move on to this, David. Do you think Juve's transfer plans will change a lot? Well, what a good transition. Do you think they'll change a lot now with Pirlo on board?
I don't. I really don't. I think Juve, the amount of money that they have to spend is what it is. It's not much. Remember, I go back to the fact that they took a lot of their older players took a big pay cut in the spring because of the virus. It would kind of be in poor taste to go make a big splurge now after they did that. I think the fact that Pirlo has a low salary there, I think the fact that they didn't go back to Allegri, which maybe was a safer pick than going with Pirlo, to me speaks volumes. A, it would have been expensive to bring Allegri back because he's no longer on the contract with Juve, and we know that Allegri wanted Juve to make a lot of changes, so I don't expect big changes with Pirlo. Now, will he have a say in some of it? I'm sure. I know he had a big meeting already with the team, but I don't expect a big revolution. I don't expect Juve to radically change their stance on Tonali and other players because Pirlo is there. I think there would have been a big change on the transfer market had sporting director Paratici also been let go, and there was some speculation on that, but ultimately that didn't happen. So no, I still think at the end of the day, the big new additions for Juve will be Arthur and Kulusevski, and whatever they can get in exchange for Bernardeschi or maybe some other players, but I don't expect big changes based on this hire.
Okay. All right, David, well, let's transition to a different Serie A team. What are the odds Napoli sign left back from La Liga, Sergio Reguilón?
Yeah, so the report over the weekend is that Napoli are interested, but there was caution in that report that he also has a big market in the Premier League. So I don't expect Napoli to be the favorites for him. They have a good relationship with Real Madrid, but I don't expect them to be the guy. What do you think? I know he's been linked to Chelsea. Do you think he's the top choice there? I've heard also Everton as well. But what are the odds you see him going to Chelsea, Alex?
Yeah, well, the tricky thing is Ben Chilwell is certainly still the first target for Frank Lampard. He's been that the whole time, and he continues to be. And after Kai Havertz, it's either him or Declan Rice that they're prioritizing. But Chilwell's not cheap, and Reguilón is like half the price, and as is every other left-back Chelsea are rumored for. So it's still kind of up in the air. I heard Chelsea were fairly close to Chilwell ever since Leicester dropped out of Champions League. So I don't know. And also, David, Reguilón's agent is Kia. And Kia has really close relationships with Everton, the other team that he's rumored to, and Chelsea, of course. And Kia, when I've asked my sources about Reguilón to Chelsea, they say maybe there's some truth, but Kia could easily just be spouting and spouting and spouting to raise the overall price. So I'm not sure anybody really knows what team is closest because the agent is really doing classic agent stuff here. So, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I guess there is some interest from Chelsea, but I don't think it's going to happen personally to Chelsea. All right, David. Well, let's move to this last subject in the hot transfer topic segment. Can we expect big changes at Torino now that Giampaolo is in charge?
Yeah, and very interestingly, last season, Torino went all in with continuity, basically brought back the same squad, just added Verdi, kept Mazzarri. While continuity worked very well for Lazio up until the pandemic ended the season, the opposite was true for Torino. So, yeah, there's going to be big changes. A, they're going to change formation, go to a four-man defense. I think there's a lot of players at Torino that want to leave and have new motivation. So I think you'll see Sirigu, Ansaldi, players like Iwana Arevizo and Nkolo, maybe both leave. I think Belotti will stay, but a lot of other changes. And Giampaolo's linked to a lot of his former players at both Milan and Sampdoria. Ricardo Rodriguez seems the most likely. There also is Kurtic, and there's been some former Sampdoria players like Murru, Linetti, plays like that. So I do think Torino is going to be one of the few teams, I should say, in Serie A that changes a lot because, again, They have a lot of players that want new motivations and the change in formation. So let's see what happens there with Gianpaolo. So before we get to Mark Doyle for Atalanta, which will be available to all, we're going to do a segment for patrons only. As I mentioned, we are moving more and more stuff to Patreon. I have my column, the Transfer Rumor Raider column, is now on Patreon. ESPN rightfully wants to, can't really focus too much on freelance writers like me. They need to keep their regular writers employed. So I moved it over there. We have a lot of bonus content on Patreon. We have Napoli Outsiders coming back on with an interview that'll be exclusive on Patreon. We have a lot of great articles. So if you enjoy the podcast, I definitely recommend becoming a patron. You'll also be supporting a great charity in Italy, the Insuperabili, which run football camps for kids with disability. Okay, so I'm very excited to be joined by our next guest. I definitely wanted to talk about Atalanta to kind of wrap up their great season in Serie A. They're getting ready to play in the Champions League. And our dear friend Mark Doyle, who is based in Bologna, Italy, and is the deputy features editor at Goal, has kind of by default become one of our Atalanta guests because he has a big passion for the team and it's been going on for a while. So it's always a pleasure to welcome my dear friend Mark back to Calcioland to talk about Atalanta. So bentornato, Mark. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Cheers. It's always fantastic to be on the show, and it's always, always a pleasure, always good fun to talk about Atalanta in particular. But I'm also delighted to be back because I know you had had a tough spell yourself there recently, so I'm delighted you're back doing the show. And as a fan of the show as well, I'm delighted that everything's got up and running again and you're doing well.
Well, I really appreciate that, Mark, and the help and support of people like you makes a big difference. And it's wonderful to get back at it and talk calcio with you. So let's talk a little bit about Atalanta. Obviously, they're getting ready in the Champions League. I feel like they have become kind of the darling Italian team. I think they are definitely the team we might remember the most fondly from this season. But, you know, there might be some people who aren't that familiar with Atalanta who maybe just see the goal tally, hear a little bit about the players that they have and whatnot. But since you're a keen observer of Atalanta and Italian football in general, how would you describe Atalanta to someone who really isn't that familiar with them?
I think the first word that kind of comes to mind for me is joyous. I find them an absolute pleasure to watch. I find them they're so much fun. I always go back to the when they beat Valencia in the first leg of the last 16 Champions League earlier this year. And I remember after the match, we were all the press were sitting downstairs in the press conference, and Gasparini came into the room and a lot of journalists, you know, you're supposed to maintain your objectivity and your impartiality. And they started clapping. They applauded him into the room. And he very quickly said, look, we've won nothing yet. We've won one game tonight. It's not like we've won a trophy. And he said, right, they haven't won anything. But what they're doing definitely deserves celebrating. And there's so much goodwill towards them at the moment because they're a high-energy side that plays attacking football. They're a team that is far greater than the sum of their parts on paper. In an era in which money dominates football and makes the world go round in particular, they're not even among the top 30 clubs in Europe in terms of revenue, according to the last Deloitte Money Football League. And yet here they are in the last day of the Champions League against PSG, who have about four times their budget. So for me, it is really joyous to see them play. And they represent hope, I think, for small clubs everywhere. They show what can be done when everyone at the same club has bought into an idea and is working together. Everybody's rowing in the same direction. So they prove that what you can do with a strong belief in your youth system, clever financial management, shrewd signings, you're working on your own stadium, 100% faith in the coach and his vision. So I derive an awful lot of pleasure from just seeing him even on this stage, on this, and they deserve to be on the stage because it's a dark time, you know, across the world, not just for football. And it's been a really dark time for Italy for a long time and for Bergamo in particular, which was devastated by the coronavirus.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic thing to see them involved, to see them, you know, I remember Gasparini at the height of the coronavirus and the pandemic was really taking hold, and he said it almost seemed cruel that at the historic peak of sporting joy for Bergamo, it coincided with the city's greatest pain. And I mean, we all remember the images of military trucks, you know, snaking through the streets of Bergamo to transport people from the morgue, the dead bodies from the morgue to the cemetery. It was tragic. It was really, really difficult to see. And people, you know, leafing through the local newspaper and just obituary after obituary. Yeah. It's a devastating. These are not just numbers over here. You know, people died. Families were devastated. People couldn't say goodbye to their loved ones. So Bergamo felt that more than most. So to me, it matters a lot that Atalanta are here representing the recovery or an attempt to make sense of this. Like Gasparini said himself, it's going to take years for people to fully come to terms with what happened here, to comprehend the pain and suffering. So it matters not just because of the financial aspects and the sporting side of things. In an era in which football has become less competitive and there's more and more money in the game and there's only a select group of clubs that can win the major trophies, it's important that Atalanta, who are punching above their weight, are represented on such a global stage. So, and in a year that is a very, very tough and difficult 2020, I think Atalanta are kind of like the fairy tale we need. So I remember even the mayor of Bergamo saying before the win over Valencia, we wouldn't just like to win, we also need it. And I don't think that's changed. If anything, that desire for Atalanta, for football even in general, to help the healing process to a degree, in any small way it can, is stronger than it was back then. So, and Gasparini, I remember, said as well, after all the pain in the morning, Atalanta can help Bergamo start again. So it really will be joyous to see them on the field this week for so many reasons.
What a great answer. I love that you picked joyous. Obviously, what happened to Bergamo, their style of play, I think they are rightfully being rewarded for doing so many things right. Mm. So really well said. I agree there. So I got to be honest, I didn't think Atalanta was going to repeat their season from last year. I didn't pick them to make it back to the Champions League. Not only did they do that, but they are the Italian team that went the furthest in the Champions League. So much for Andrea Agnelli's quotes on, you know, contributions to rankings and whatnot. That stuff doesn't matter once you take to the pitch. So, but I want to ask you, what surprised you more? That Atalanta repeated in Serie A and are finished in the top four again, or that they have gone this far in the Champions League?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? Because it's, you know, taken separately, they're two sensational results. Put together, it's even more remarkable. It's even more staggering because, you know, competing on two fronts tests your squad to the absolute limit. So it's incredible that they've been able to balance these kind of twin goals and are still here and having, yeah, finished third in the league and now are you know, playing for a place in the semi-finals of the Champions League. It's kind of ridiculous. So, I mean, on one hand, I'm tempted to say the league is the bigger surprise, the bigger achievement, because it's a longer competition. It's a true test of a team's consistency. But I think, yeah, what's really remarkable about Atalanta being in the quarters is they look certain to be eliminated in the group stage. I mean, they lost their first three games. I think they had 1 point after the first four games. They were almost out of the tournament, and they were taking some bad beatings in the Champions League at the start as well. And
I remember
Papu Gomez saying, you know, we learned a really harsh lesson against Dinamo, but that's the key to it. I mean, they clearly did. They are fast learners. They did learn from the step up in quality. Like, and people didn't expect them to struggle so badly against teams like Dinamo, and they learned from it and they recovered and they fully deserve to go through by the end. And then we saw what they produced against Valencia, which I think was when the rest of Europe actually stood up and said, you know what, this is a really fun team. This is a fantastic side to watch. They've got attacking players all over the place. They just want to go forward all the time. So I think the whole season as altogether is a triumph. Like you said, I remember we talked about Atalanta at the start of the season. And when we were both, I was kind of saying, I hope they can repeat it, but it's definitely going to be really, really difficult. So, they just deserve credit for the season as a whole, and in a way, it doesn't really matter if they go through against PSG. You know, obviously they're a colossal financial heavyweight. It's more that they're here, that they're still here, and that they'll be here again next season. You mentioned Agnelli; he wasn't even sure if they deserved to be in the tournament. You know, even though they qualified via the league, and yet here they are. They're going back for the second consecutive season. So this is a triumph already. This is already a victory. So I'm just delighted about that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Same here. No doubt about it. So now let's talk a little bit about Papu Gomez, who is probably the most representative player on the team. Yeah. So Dybala won the MVP in Serie A. We could go on about that decision. But let me ask you, in your opinion, do you think Papu Gomez should have won the most valuable player in Serie A? And if you had to make the case for him winning the award, what would that sound like?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think he was the symbol of the side. He definitely represents everything that they're about. He was the best player in the team that have again been the story of the season for the reasons we've just outlined. So I did feel he deserved it. I'm surprised he was overlooked. And I mean, we were joking not recently at goal about people were saying Lewandowski was robbed of the Ballon d'Or because they decided to cancel it for a year. And I just interjected and saying, well, Papu Gomez was robbed, in my opinion, half jokingly. But he's been extraordinary this season. And I did think he probably would. I thought he would be rewarded for being the inspiration behind this remarkable Atalanta fairy tale. So, I mean, and the numbers are there to make a strong case for him as well. I think he has the most assists in a single season since Opta began recording such statistics. So, Dybala definitely had a great season. He was the one creative spark in that Juve team that was actually, I found, quite difficult to watch at times. But Ronaldo scored a lot of goals as well. You can never not mention him. And Immobile scored even more. So, I mean, there was some strong competition, and Dybala is a great story as well because he enjoyed a remarkable turnaround when you consider they tried to sell him last year. So
yeah,
he deserves credit for that. But for me, yeah, Atalanta and Gomez are the real story, are the real MVPs. But even though they haven't got the individual awards, maybe that's because it's all about a collective success there, and it's a triumph of everybody pushing in the same direction. So. At the end of the day, it doesn't undermine what they've done, but yeah, it would have been nice to see Papu at his age win the MVP. I think he would. There's hardly anybody in the world, any neutrals, that would have begrudged him that.
Yeah, for sure. So now let's talk about Ilicic, who unfortunately won't be part of the match against PSG for personal reasons. But, we were talking at the top how Atalanta has done so many things right, and you can make a case if Papu Gomez is Atalanta's best player, Ilicic is right behind him. But look, Atalanta's done a great job with depth. Muriel as a backup striker scored a ton of goals. Pasalic, yeah, too, who's kind of their 12th man, kind of a starter, but not really, has done really well. So when you look at Atalanta's squad, and particularly these two, do you think they can even overcome the fact that Ilicic isn't going to play against PSG in the Champions League?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point about the squad. Because you think about it, there's no way they should have that kind of depth. I think it's the 13th biggest budget in the league. It's staggering that they have all these players on the bench that can come on and make a difference. Looking at the guys like Malinowski as well at the end of the season,
yeah,
they're chipping in with great goals. And they're even alternative. They can rotate wing backs and stuff like that. So and on paper, again, you look at this. If you were looking at this two seasons ago, you go, oh, okay, the squad is decent, but it's not amazing whatsoever. They've definitely overachieved, and that a lot of that must go down to Gasperini and how he's managing them. But again, Ilicic, as we know, as you know well, I'm a massive, massive fan of Ilicic. I love his style. I love the way he plays. And if you take him out of the team, you do lose a certain X factor. I remember someone saying recently over here, was a Cassano, saying that Juve, taking Ilicic out of the team would be like Juve without Ronaldo. And it's an exaggeration, but you get the message. He's key. He's a total maverick. He's capable of producing something out of nothing off either foot, which is an immense talent. And you just look at his performance at Mestalla when, he was absolutely sensational. He was almost unplayable on the night. So, and I find it a shame, actually, more than anything else as well. It's taken him such a long time to get to this point. So it's a real pity he's not able to play for whatever reason. I genuinely think he's as big a loss to the fixture as Kylian Mbappe would be if he doesn't play for PSG. I know he has his fitness issue. So that, to me, is how much I enjoy watching this guy play. But your point is excellent. Atalanta have quality cover. And I've seen it argued recently as well that they don't just have a 12th man; they have a 13th, 14th, and 15th. And
yeah,
that little bit of depth has been invaluable. It certainly won't scare them. There's nothing to lose. They know they can win without Ilicic. We've already seen that this season. You brought up a guy like Muriel. It's invaluable to have these guys on the bench that can come in and score goals like that. So Atalanta, certainly, I suppose, if you're going to take out a player, I mean, they have so much going forward, they have so much creativity, there's so much energy and drive about them that you would hope that they would get by without Ilicic. But he will be missed. It's just a question of how much. But ultimately, the success of the team is down to the quality and attitude of the players, some outstanding coaching from a tactical and management point of view. So again, that's what they're going to be relying on to get them past a pretty daunting opponent in PSG.
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you about Gosens in this way. So look, you know, in recent years, and I've used the term Gasperini fool's gold, we've had, you know, some players that left Atalanta didn't do so well at other clubs. Yeah. Cristante comes to mind, Caldara's back at the club, Conti, you know, others as well. Now, there's been some others. Kessie had a really nice turnaround and whatnot. But when you look at Gosens, who's been really sensational, scored a ton of goals and assists, you see him as someone who can do well on another team as well, or do you see him as someone who really is a product of the Gasperini system?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. As you said, it's not just exclusive to Atalanta. We have seen players at, you know, various other clubs and various other leagues. If you take them out of a very kind of disciplined, strict system, take them out of a certain environment and put them in another club under another coach, sometimes it doesn't work out. And he's clearly talented. He's been absolutely fantastic this season, as you said. His numbers are outstanding. But there is that element of Atalanta, or maybe Gasperini in particular. They have a habit of making players better, and that doesn't happen at every club. They have an ability to coax the absolute maximum, or for a player to even exceed maybe what you previously thought he was capable of. And that doesn't happen everywhere. I mean, I look at Barcelona and the amount of players they've signed over the years, and you think, over the last 5 years in particular, you think, oh, that's a quality player, that's a quality signing, and it just doesn't work. It's just they don't fit in the system, they're not coached properly or whatever. So at Atlanta, everything seems to work perfectly, as I kind of alluded to earlier on. Also, wing backs can be funny as well. Sometimes someone like Marcus Alonso at Chelsea, if you put a guy like that playing at left back, it doesn't work. He's not good enough defensively. If he's playing for the forward, he's not a complete all-round attacker. So they can be very, very suited to certain roles and certain formations of certain systems. So he could well be one of those players. But I also think that for the reason, what is he, 26 now, and he suddenly kind of exploded over the last season or so. And I think of Papu Gomez as well, who said, you know, I didn't meet, he said the great tragedy is that he didn't meet Gasperini until he was like 28. He would have learned so much more. So as he said himself, he changed his life because he changed his position and gave him a total different understanding of the game. So Gosens could well be one of those players that he would only be this effective in this team playing this way under this coach. So I don't know. I don't want to belittle him or whatever, because I think he's fantastic. He's been brilliant this season. But there is always that risk, and it's just a fascinating question, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. So let's close on this. So we talked about some of maybe the most well-known players on Atalanta. I was actually thinking back to one of our conversations a while back where we were talking about Golini potentially being, you know, someone who holds Atalanta back compared to some of the keepers on the other Serie A teams, and he ended up having a great season. I know he might miss PSG, but are there some Atalanta players beyond the top ones that you think are unsung and more people need to pay attention to?
Yeah, I think there are, people are going to be studying them very closely tomorrow. And I think the point you made about the squad is very, very valid. And you're going to see that it's a collection of really good footballers, or at the very least, they're ideally suited to the football they're playing. Obviously, the guys in the attack, Zapata and Ilicic and all these fellas, and Gomez get an awful lot of credit, and even Malinovsky, you know, attracts attention because he just strikes the ball so viciously and violently that he scores these eye-catching goals. You mentioned the 12-man Pasalic as well. But I often think the work of Freuler and De Bruyne in midfield is overlooked, because they have a very key role in the team that is so attack-minded, where the full-backs like the wing-backs like to bomb forward, the front three are so focused on doing their job at the other end of the pitch. They also have to protect the defence, I think, that sometimes can be exposed, that plays one-on-one at the back, that they take a lot of risks. So, and even if you just look at the average ratings, you know, something like Gazzetta, you see that the two lads in the middle of the park are just you know, 6.5 out of 10 nearly every single week. You know, ratings are really harsh in Italy. They're really, you really have to impress, but they're so solid and they're so reliable. And I find them very consistent, and they do a really great and important role in such an offensively minded team. So, and they'll be key actually against Paris Saint-Germain, I think, as well, to see how they play. Obviously, the press will be hugely important. A lot of people think PSG might not be able to handle how Atalanta go about the pressing opposition high up the pitch. So they're going to have to get through a lot of work in midfield. They're going to have to try and protect the defence. It's going to, at this stage, looks like it might play 1v1 against one of the most exciting attacks in the world. So they have a huge role to play, and this will be a real test of their talent as well.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough. It's great to catch up with you, my friend, and to talk about Atalanta. Definitely check out Mark's work. You know, I love chatting with him. I love that he's based in Italy, really understands what's going on there. So check out his work. Recently wrote about Osimhen. And, you know, my friend, I look forward to chatting again with you real soon on the podcast, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. And it's great to be back on the show as well. I really appreciate it. Always a blast. Thank you.